The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Monday, May 6th, 2024. 7 minutes past the hour, I'm Eric White filling in for Tom Temin. Our producer is Peter Masurlian. Our web editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darius Lauderdale. Coming up this hour of the Federal Drive, the Energy Department looks to draw out a route of how to get those clean energy projects going. Plus, it's officially awards season for outstanding feds. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of the Federal Drive. But first, the Department of Veterans Affairs' most important metric for measuring customer experience is on the rise. The VA finds veteran trust in outpatient care has increased to nearly 92%. That's a big improvement from when the department first gathered this data in 2016. The VA is also focused on making it easier for active duty service members to transition back to civilian life. For an update on all of this, Federal News Network's Jory Heckman spoke with VA's Chief Veterans Experience Officer, John Bursler.
When we started measuring customer experience in 2016, trust, ease, effectiveness, and emotion, we're at 55% trust with veterans and their families. Now we stand almost at 80% and at 79%, which is pretty incredible, the journey that we've been on over those intervening years. And the best way to describe it, then the best way that we've actually gotten to those that grade score and aspirationally wanting to be at 90%, of course, is really the employees that make up VA. So our 400,000 plus incredible humans that are working out in the hospitals and the clinics and the regional benefits offices and the cemeteries every day to improve the lives of our veterans. And training them and how to deliver a world-class customer experience has really been where the rubber meets the road. So as y'all probably talk about a lot with other customer experience professionals, you know, you can't have a world-class customer experience without a world-class employee experience. So literally arming our employees with better training and better tools and better data so that they can properly engage those veterans and their families and deliver that world-class experience has been really impactful for us. We've had a couple of other big wins in terms of looking at how we are codified, not only within the department, but now we have some legislation that wants to codify the Veterans Experience Office within statute, which is very exciting. And I think it's a necessary mechanism for us to really show how impactful and how important this office is to the overall success of VA, just as many other offices are across the federal government. But as we're looking forward, I think some of the most exciting opportunities for us are not only to codify the Veterans Experience Office and thereby permanently codify customer experience and employee experience at the Department of Veterans Affairs, but really thinking about how we readjust our customer acquisition funnel. You know, government really doesn't think about how we might acquire more customers and ensure that we're delivering a great experience. And so it's been really fun to think about that in the last 3+ years that I've been back in service and what pain points, bright spots, and moments that matter along the individual veteran journey are most important that we can really focus on. And I'd love to talk more about some of those here today.
Great introduction to the topic here. And I think you really hit on the wide scope of what VA does for veterans. It is the healthcare side of things. It is the benefits side of things. To look at one particular strand of things here, the Biden administration has really been looking at life experiences as a lens to improve customer experience. And I know that VA is really closely involved in one of those, and that is the experience of transitioning from active duty military to being a veteran, going back to civilian life and figuring out things there. What is VA doing to improve that experience? What have the pain points been as of late, and how are you guys looking to make that a more seamless transition for veterans?
As I kind of referred to a second ago, thinking about readjusting that customer acquisition funnel is a huge opportunity. And our first touch point with our soon-to-be veterans, those transitioning service members, those young men and women and their families that are leaving the military, that's our first opportunity to really wow them, to really delight them, to really ensure that they have a successful reintegration from military to civilian life. And in many ways, we're not designing for that persona or multiple personas, as we discovered after interviewing hundreds of transitioning service members, recently separated veterans, and their family members. We were able to develop four of those types of persona types that you can see on the performance.gov website that we've been able to publish with our partners at the Department of Defense, Department of Labor, Office of Management and Budget, et cetera. And I think making sure that we're better understanding what their pain points are along that journey, namely that, you know, we have to think about it from a generational lens. Like these, most of the active military force, all six service branches and the Enterprise Defense Department, they're millennials and Gen Z, right? That are raising their right hand and swearing in to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And a lot of our course materials and our curriculum, just what we found was didn't really resonate with those generations. And so how might we make a more immersive experience in the Transition Assistance Program one-day course? And how might we present this information about the benefits and the health care that they're eligible for much further upstream? Almost every individual we spoke with who was either in the process of separating from the military or had recently separated from the military, they said, I wish I had known about this benefit or this program earlier. I wish that I could have engaged. I wish that my spouse could have attended the course with me. I wish that I had started the transition assistance program pathway at the right time, because it's required to start it at least 1 year before separation for those individuals leaving the military after a few terms, and 24 months, 2 years for those that are retiring. So we're working in the interagency space. Like I mentioned, all six service branches, Enterprise Defense Department, Department of Labor, Office of Management and Budget, Department of Education, Small Business Administration, you name it, everyone that has a stake in that process on the federal government side. And of course, VA. We have the most vested interest, is in my view, to really rethink and redesign this experience for not only the different types of personas that we're now aware of, but really thinking about it, personalizing it. So later this, right now we're developing a minimum viable product that will solve for a lot of the pain points that I mentioned earlier. It'll allow them to enroll into a digital experience right after they finish their training school at the beginning of their service, so that they're able to then understand exactly what they need and when they need to pursue it based on their expiration of term of service date or their EAS date. You know, we call it different things in different service branches. And then we'll send them pushes along that journey when they're eligible. So automatically when they enlist or they commission, they're eligible for VA home loans. They're eligible to call the Veteran Crisis Line if they need to. They're eligible to go to one of our 300 vet centers for, you know, family counseling or mental health counseling, or to be a part of a peer support group. And then as they get closer to that 12 months prior to separation, and then even that 6 months prior to separation, they're allowed to file a disability claim. They're allowed to start exploring their GI Bill education benefits. They're allowed to do so many other things, but just making them more aware and personalizing it based on exactly what their priorities are when they are planning to leave the military, whether that's going to school, whether that's getting a new job, whether that's relocating their family. There's so much that we could be doing to really improve this customer experience. And it's been a real pleasure to work with our interagency partners. And actually, in many ways, it's been so great to see the six service branches that run the Transition Assistance Program on the Defense Department side really get excited about human-centered design and the methodology that we use, the ethnographic research, the in-depth interviews, the focus groups, the journey mapping, the service blueprinting, and the persona work that we've done with them. So hopefully we'll have a product to test this summer, and then, you know, fingers crossed, launch later this year in the fall.
That was John Bursler, VA's Chief Veterans Experience Officer, speaking with Federal News Network's Jory Heckman. You can find more from our CX Exchange at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come on Federal News Network, it's officially award season for outstanding feds. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Each passing year, U.S. politics seems to get uglier and more perverse. So much more reason, then, to celebrate public servants whose goal in life is high-quality mission delivery. And that's what this year's Service to America Medal's finalists just announced demonstrate. Commitment to the mission and to the finest in public service. Joining Federal Drive host Tom Temin, as he does every year for a preview, the president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, Max Steyer.
Golly, you know, looking at the list of finalists, which are just out really this morning or came out last night, the breadth of areas that touch so much of American life, land management and forestry, drug safety, tax administration, even the operation of the government itself, the breadth of areas that the SAMMY's finalists cover is really impressive.
Absolutely. And it's worth noting that we had over 530 nominations this year. And what you're seeing is the impossible task of choosing extraordinary people among amazing people. And you're right, it covers the warp. There are 14 different cabinet agencies that are represented here, 25 finalist groups, there are 43 total people. And it does mean that we've got a government that's working on all cylinders and helping us in a myriad of ways. Just to add on to some of the examples you gave, you know, wonderful story of the Department of Labor inspectors saving children from being forced to work in dangerous and unhealthy environments and looking to save the bee industry, which is so fundamental to our agricultural system, to the incredible story of the amazingly quick repair of the interstate in Pennsylvania. I mean, it goes on and on and on, and it's a plentiful set of incredible people doing a very important work for the American people.
One of the ones of the many that stood out shows that even in places like the White House, which are just nothing but lightning rods nowadays, but Kyle Gardner is a senior policy analyst, and this is a career person. This is not somebody who's Trump or Biden or anything. Office of Management and Budget, streamlining burdensome government forms. You know, even in the digital age, there is plenty of room for reform in that manner. And there's somebody deep in OMB. I think the public doesn't appreciate that there are actually civil servants, even within the White House, that do things away from the politics and away from all of that, that have real benefit.
100%. And another additional positive mark in Kyle's favor is that this is the emerging leader category. So that means that these are people who are relatively new to the workplace and yet making an exceptional difference in the work that they are doing. And we have four emerging leader nominees, including Andrea Fletcher, who is doing incredible work at CMS to create online services that help patients dispute unexpected medical bills. You have Sammy DeFoya, who has been spearheading the work to try to help what's happening in Haiti. You have Jerry Ma, who's at the Patent and Trademark Office, who is applying AI technology to improve the innovation agency in our government and beyond. I mean, it's really just a spirit-lifting set of extraordinary people.
The other thing that I see from year to year is the way in which oversight, which can be a little bit contentious among government functionaries, but can also lead to real results. I'm looking at Beza Repko. She's director of physical infrastructure issues at the GAO. She's been on this show, led critical research projects that exposed gaps in vehicle safety features, uncovered shortcomings in the reliability of U.S. rail and highway systems. So this is where someone totally outside, say, of DOT can, yes, oversee them, but also enhance the work they do.
Yes, and I do think the oversight function is fundamental. Some years back, we created the management excellence category as a place of recognition because there's so much about our government that is, as you just noted, the internal functioning is less accessible for people to understand and yet is vital in terms of what is achieved. And another example of that is Mike Schmidt and the CHIPS team that is really at the forefront of trying to ensure that our country has a vibrant CHIPS industry, the brains of the modern digital environment that we live in. And they had to set this up from scratch and have done just an extraordinary job of figuring out how to provide support to the right places to make sure that we have a healthy chip industry in this country, which is a matter of vital importance to us.
We're speaking with Max Steyer, president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. And just one more I wanted to note to show how these winners and finalists can be ripped out of the headlines, to use a cliche. Trevor McAleenan, Special IRS Agent, Criminal Investigation Division, and Michael Lane, also of the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. They led a study that led to the seizure of $3 billion of Bitcoin. Boy, that's certainly been in the news in the last year.
Yes. And once more, our government has to keep up with the world around it. Law enforcement is an age-old responsibility of our government, but plainly things like cryptocurrencies is a new world. And it does, I think, highlight the importance of, you know, investing in our workforce and getting new talent in so that we have available to us the best-in-class talent for new issues that are arising every day.
And review for us the program that happens now. The finalists have been revealed, but there's a whole lot of events between now and the fall.
Absolutely. So we will be hosting a reception to honor the honorees, and they are finalists, but truth be told, there's really no good way of distinguishing them from the ultimate winners other than we have a selection committee of prominent government, business, philanthropic leaders that will select among them, not a job that one should envy. And we'll have a gala, ultimately, to recognize everybody, but especially those winners at the Kennedy Center on September 11th this year. You know, plainly an important date in terms of our country and highlighting the value of our government and what it does, because at the end of the day, keeping us safe is the most fundamental responsibility of our government. So lots to do here to celebrate them. It's so important. This is Public Service Recognition Week, and if we want the success as a society that we have to continue, we really need to respect, honor, and support the civil servants that are day in, day out, night in, night out, making sure that we are protected and helped in so many different ways.
And if you look at the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey scores and so forth, and look at the energy that goes into the work that results in SAMMY Awards and so on, it's remarkable the degree, and I see this in my daily interactions with feds, is yes, there's all of these stories going on about, you know, unelected bureaucrats doing this or that, and this agency is all political, and you know the headlines. But it doesn't really penetrate to them that much, to their daily lives. They really seem to almost chuckle at it and have the ability to just to go on and keep their head pointed to where it needs to be to get the job done and let the rest of that stuff just filter out.
Yes. I mean, I think the challenge, though, is we should not take these people for granted. And that's the intent here. You're right. There are a lot of headlines challenging our current system. The truth of the matter, though, is that we are blessed with a government made up of people who are expert, that are nonpartisan, and that are in their jobs to serve the public. And that's something that enables us to meet the challenges of the day. Most countries in the world do not have this, and most countries, therefore, do not have the opportunities that we have here in our country. And if we do not take care of it, if we do not invest in those people, we won't. This is not a foregone conclusion that this is the way it has to be here. And I think that is part and parcel of Public Service Recognition Week, of the SAMMYs, as you say, the best places to work, which is really a way of looking at organizational health. We need leaders in government and outside government who are really committed to and prioritizing the people of government and keeping up with the world around us.
And finally, we should point out to people that might be tuning into the SAMMYs idea for the first time, SAMMY, there was a Sam that this is all named after. Maybe remind us of that great Samuel.
Yes. And so it's interesting, though, because this program started, you know, it's one of our very first program almost 23 years ago. It's Service to America Medals. And obviously, we played off the Uncle Sam notion, but our founder was Samuel J. Hayman. When he passed away, we chose to recognize him through this program. It's just a coincidence that his name is Samuel, and so it fit particularly well here. But again, he was a businessman who recognized that, you know, he could not be a successful businessman or a successful and safe American without the best in class going into government, and he wanted to make sure that happened. So this is our way of doffing our hat at him, at his ideas, and his support for the Partnership for Public Service.
Max Steyer is president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, speaking there with Federal Drive host Tom Temin. We'll post this interview along with a link to more information about this year's SAMMYs finalists at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Be sure to tune in every week as we interview some of those finalists up until the actual award ceremony. You can also hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come on Federal News Network, Congress faces another countdown, this time to reauthorize the FAA. But first, the Energy Department looks to draw out a route of how to get those clean energy projects going. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. In an effort to clear the existing backlog of solar, wind, and battery projects seeking to be built, the Energy Department has created a new roadmap with some ways to get them connected to the nation's grid faster. It's called the Transmission Interconnection Roadmap, and DOE hopes it will help it hit targets for interconnection improvement by 2030. To learn more about this tool, I speak to Becca Jones-Albertus, who is director of DOE's Solar Energy Technologies Office. Becca, thank you so much for taking the time.
Great to be here, Eric.
So why don't we just start with an overview of what this interconnection roadmap is and just sort of how it all came together, and then we can kind of get into the mission of it.
At the Department of Energy, we are focused on how we can enable the president's goal of decarbonizing our electricity grid by 2035. To get there, we need to rapidly increase the amount of solar, wind, and battery storage that we are deploying. One of the barriers we need to overcome to accelerate that deployment is interconnection. Interconnection, along with siting of projects, supply chain challenges, those are some of the biggest challenges to be overcome to enable greater solar, wind, and energy storage deployments. Specific to interconnection, we have seen a substantial rise in the number of projects that are submitting applications to grid operators to interconnect to the grid in recent years. And we've seen the backlog of those projects growing tremendously. And so while it used to take just a couple of years to get through an interconnection queue, we're now seeing projects on average taking 5 years to come out of queues. We now have as much solar and energy storage in the interconnection queues as we would need to deploy over the next decade to get to our clean energy goals. But at the same time, we're seeing that less than 20% of the projects that enter those queues are being built. So we're seeing a problem that's kind of exacerbating year over year, where there's more projects going into the queues slowing down, and then there's less information about which projects will be viable at the end of that process. And so then more projects are put into the queue, and we continue to exacerbate that problem. So this is a major issue that we've been focused on addressing at DOE. And as one of the major pillars of that work, we developed this interconnection roadmap. So we have a larger effort that's called the Interconnection Innovation Exchange, or I2X, which is bringing together stakeholders to address the challenges related to interconnection to get to fairer, simpler, and more equitable practices. And that effort has been a large stakeholder group. And one of the big pillars has been this roadmap. And so over a nearly 2 year process, since we launched the I2X program, we've been working to develop the roadmap, held 22 meetings with stakeholders, got feedback from more than 2,000 participants on the challenges that need to be solved, pathways of solving those challenges. And the result is a roadmap that we hope can be an integrated solution set for DOE to use in its funding opportunities, for industry and other stakeholder groups to use as well in targeting their efforts to improve interconnection processes.
All right. And forgive me for making us back up even more. Interconnection, that means that the technology is there to generate power, but this is the process of actually connecting it to the power supply.
The interconnection process is what the name of the process is called, where a new power plant gets permission from the grid to connect to the grid and to provide power into the grid. And so what has to happen on the grid side is that they have to ensure that that particular location can handle that influx of power coming onto the grid, that it can do so in a safe way, and that involves studying what will happen to the grid if you add that power, and studying whether there's new equipment needed onto the grid, which we often can call upgrades. If there are upgrades, what do those cost? Are they cost prohibitive or not? It studies how that additional power that comes on the grid might contribute to congestion or might influence adjacent areas. So there's a number of engineering studies that need to be done to determine whether a particular location is viable for generating a bunch of power and putting it on the grid.
Gotcha. All right. So it seems as if the current situation might be, you know, a good problem to have. You've got all this power and infrastructure ready to go. It's just the actual case of getting it started up. You laid out some of the challenges. Is it just more of a fact of you don't have everything you need and that's the reason for the backlog? Or is there just sort of a log jam of just how long it takes to get something implemented into it?
There's a log jam of how long it takes to get through these processes. The models and methods that currently exist today for evaluating the addition of new generation or storage on the grid are not suitable for the volumes that we have. So, you know, we're looking at how can we develop better tools and models to make some of this process more automated and faster. Another source of problem is that today, the developers who are putting these power projects together, they don't really have any visibility into what locations are good for the grid. And so they end up using the interconnection process to pare down their projects. So they might be looking at five different sites for building a project, and they're not sure which one will be cost effective to put onto the grid, because they don't have a way to get that information. So they submit all five into the queue, even though they're only intending to build one. And so that whole evaluation process has to go through for all five of those projects.
Just to be told no.
Yes, it's very inefficient. And so another one of the goals is to find ways that grid operators can put this information out there, so that they don't have to go through their whole evaluation process in order for developers to know whether or not a location is good. And that can cut down on the volume a lot, too.
Gotcha. We're speaking with Becca Jones-Albertus, who is director of the Energy Department's Solar Energy Technologies Office. And so let's get into the actual roadmap itself. I imagine what you just described is in there as well for reducing the amount of time it takes for interconnection. What are some of the other tools that are laid out in there for developers to consult as they are trying to develop new projects for clean energy?
So the roadmap we've put together, we want to be a roadmap for all the stakeholder groups. So that's grid operators, that's project developers, that's community organizations, that's the federal government, that's others developing solutions. And so it has solutions that are relevant for all of those groups. And then we have a set of funding at DOE that we are putting together that will address some of those targeted solutions. And then other groups may be addressing other solutions. But the roadmap is founded on collecting better data and information, which can help reduce what goes into the queue, improving the processes of evaluating projects in the queue itself, and addressing major barriers, like how, when you find out that the grid needs to be what we call upgraded, they need to add expensive new equipment, how those costs can be shared in a way that still enables projects to go forward. So sometimes today, it's just the first project that would trigger that need that would have to pay the millions of dollars, even though many projects would benefit from that. And so helping establish some processes for what's called cost allocation are another aspect or type of solution in the roadmap.
The goal is interconnection improvement by 2030. What exactly does that mean? And does that just mean a great reduction of the backlog, or, you know, a smoother transition for folks trying to get connected? What did you all have in mind when setting that goal?
We have set a number of quantitative goals, but basically we want the process to be faster. We want more of the projects that go into the process to result in real projects that go onto the grid. And we want there to be a lot more certainty and understanding of how much it will cost to interconnect the grid.
Gotcha. And so will this be something that is continuously updated, or is this going to be the end-all be-all Bible for anyone trying to develop a new project?
We think this will be a good document to guide efforts over the next several years. Hopefully at that point, we'll find we're making a lot of progress and we'll need an updated document with maybe a smaller number of actions to enable our clean energy goals and get to faster, simpler, and fairer interconnection processes. But we'll have to see how much work we can get done over the next couple of years.
Becca Jones-Albertus is director of the Energy Department's Solar Energy Technologies Office. And once again, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Eric.
And you can find this interview along with a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come on Federal News Network, Congress faces another countdown, this time to reauthorize the FAA. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom. The debate continues in Congress surrounding one of the nation's busiest airports. D.C. area lawmakers want to nix an attempt to add flights to Reagan National Airport. Hanging in the balance is a reauthorization of the Federal Aviation Administration. To get the latest, we welcome back WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller. Mitchell, thank you so much.
You bet.
So tell us what's going on here. Where do things currently stand? I guess we can start locally, since I'm sure the WTOP has been just banging on your door for updates constantly on what's going on there with Reagan National Airport.
Right. And this really is one of the most contentious issues within the more than $100 billion legislation. And that, of course, is this proposal to add 10 additional flights, five flights in, five flights out, into Reagan National Airport. And there has now been a formal amendment offered by the Virginia and Maryland senators who want to get this taken out. They are really upset over the fact that it was included by the Commerce Committee in connection with this overall bill. And they have made the argument for several weeks now that it is really going to be unsafe, that is going to add to more delays for people that go to Reagan National Airport. Virginia Senator Tim Kaine actually went on the Senate floor last week to reiterate his arguments. And he again pointed to the fact that it was just last month that there were two passenger planes that were taxiing down the runway at Reagan National on not a particularly super busy moment for the airport. And yet they came within 300 feet of each other. And as he said, this is a flashing red light to lawmakers and policymakers that this needs to be stopped. Now, on the other side, there are lawmakers from the West and other parts of the country who say that this is not that big a deal to add that many flights. And they have been pushing for this for a long time. Also, Delta Airlines is among the airlines that would like to add these slots. Interestingly, United Airlines is actually fighting them. This is part of a intra-airline battle, if you will, because United does not want Delta to get more of an advantage at Reagan National. The other thing that relates to the area airports is that Tim Kaine and others argue that the other airports, Dulles and BWI Marshall, could actually take on more flights because they have more space, whereas literally Reagan National is landlocked. So we're going to have to see what happens, but this is going to be a very, very big battle as we move forward on this FAA reauthorization bill.
Yeah, this has been one of the stranger debates that we've seen go around, especially for the D.C. area lawmakers who are pretty tight-knit community. Do they actually have any shot of getting this eliminated from the FAA reauthorization bill? Or is this just going to be, you know, they're speaking their constituents' minds, but, you know, it's not really going to do much?
It does look like there is going to be some movement on this. They have support, interestingly enough, from West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. Sometimes you don't know which side of certain issues he's going to come on, but he is against it. They've also picked up some support from some other senators. And so I think that you are going to see them dig in really, really hard on this. What's interesting about the overall bill is whether or not this is actually going to get completed in time this week. The deadline is at the end of this week. And when they broke last week, it just didn't look like senators were going to be able to make this deadline to actually reauthorize it. There is a very good possibility that they will have to do another short-term extension that was hinted at by the number two Senate Republican, John Thune, who just said, with all these amendments and this one that we've just been talking about, that's only one. There are several other amendments that a lot of other lawmakers want to get on, including those that are not necessarily really directly related to the FAA. This has become one of those legislative vehicles for a lot of other bills. So we'll have to see what happens over the next few days.
We're talking with Mitchell Miller, WTOP's Capitol Hill correspondent. Yeah, let's get into some of those other amendments that are attached to this FAA reauthorization, one in which it plans to add more air traffic controllers, which I guess you can never have enough of. But are there any other ones that they're discussing at this point?
Right. Well, there are a lot of provisions in here for airline safety, and they do have pretty widespread support. Among them, as you mentioned, adding air traffic controllers. There's also new technology that the FAA wants to implement. implement that would prevent the type of collisions that were that was cited by Senator Kaine, the concern about these planes on runways taxiing and then getting very close to each other. So they have cited that. Also, for just consumers, people planning to fly this summer, the legislation would prohibit airlines from charging extra for families to sit together, and it would raise fines for airlines that violate various consumer laws. So there's still a lot to discuss, and this certainly has a direct impact on a lot of people. It's not just one of those policy issues that's up in the sky, if you will.
Yeah, it'll especially end those videos of folks trying to shame those who don't move for children when trying to get families to sit together. So let's talk other agency news. It looks as if Congress is trying to get an update on just how many workers are going back into the office. They had a goal that they set for them. How are agencies doing in getting all those employees working back in the offices?
Well, of course, it depends on who you ask. If you ask the agencies themselves, including OMB, they say that there is significant progress being made. On the other side, House Republicans in particular are really pushing back on whether or not enough is being done. There was a somewhat contentious hearing last week with the House Oversight Committee, James Comer leading that hearing. And one of those who's testified was OMB Deputy Director for Management, Jason Miller. Now, he said essentially that OMB and these agencies are moving forward as they are expected to do to get 50% of their employees working in their office. He also pointed out that many employees simply do not have any access to telework because of the nature of their jobs. He said, so if you add all of those in on a given day, there could be 80% of federal workers actually at the physical workplace where they're supposed to be. Now, on the other hand, Republicans say they are not getting the data and the drilled down information that they really have been pushing for months, trying to get the exact figures from all of these agencies. And then, as you well know, Federal News Network did an extensive survey of federal workers, and it does appear that most workers, about nearly two-thirds, have some type of hybrid setup, with about 30% saying they are fully remote, and a very small percentage actually said that they were working entirely in the office. And that is one of the things that upsets a lot of Republican lawmakers.
Yeah. And so are they going to be pushing any other initiatives to kind of force agencies' hands, or do you see this just, you know, the status quo is going to just keep on going until they can get a better update?
I think it's going to come through oversight. I think not only in the House, but you have Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, as you know, has been very active on this issue. And I think that the Republicans are just going to keep pushing to get these agencies to come up with specific figures that actually show that they do have 50% of their employees working in the office. On the other hand, you're going to have the federal unions who have pushed back a lot. And, you know, I think it's going to be a bit of a tug of war as it's been over the last few years. You know, a lot of federal workers, as you know, have said that what is the point of going into the office if I have to fight traffic for an extended amount of time? I get in, I'm stressed out, and then it turns out that I, as a federal worker, am just basically working virtually on another call that I could have done from my home. So I think you're just going to see this push back and forth between federal workers, the unions, and a lot of lawmakers here on Capitol Hill.
And you can see that in other areas in the private sector as well. And one agency that is dealing currently and trying to figure out its remote policy is the IRS, who has extended its remote work pilot and is also planning to make its workforce a little bigger. What are their plans and how do we see that playing out?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of activity within the IRS, and there has been some positive feelings about that on Capitol Hill, that things are really moving forward now after a long time where the IRS was backlogged with all kinds of tax documents, the IT issue, as you know. But what the IRS is now planning to do is it's going to extend its remote work pilot through early next year, basically toward the end of January of next year. It was scheduled to end actually just before the summer kicked off this year. So they want to basically look at what kind of things are happening within that program. One of the things that they are finding initially is that they are getting more interest in the agency with remote work, pointing out that a lot of the work can be done remotely with the IRS. And then the other issue, as you point out, is the hiring that is taking place at IRS. And it's continues to move forward, and that is due largely to that $60 billion that was approved through the legislation that allowed for a lot of the hiring that the IRS has been doing over the last year. There is still some contentiousness back and forth with lawmakers because there were some cuts in that, as you know, but they have put in a lot of money toward their IT situation. They have really picked up the pace on getting all of that backlog basically wiped out. And then in terms of hiring right now through the Inflation Reduction Act, that was the original legislation I was referring to earlier, they actually grew to about 90,000 full-time employees, and that's up more than 10,000 than it was just a couple of years ago. And the IRS commissioner indicated to Congress that they are now looking to actually have more than 100,000 total employees within the next 5 years. So they are really beefing up at the IRS. And what they point out is that when they have more money, when they have more staffing, when they're more efficient, that they can actually bring in more money. Now, on the other side, Republicans say they are targeting a lot of Americans. It's particularly wealthy Americans to bring in that money. And there are actually going to be a lot more audits that are done both at the corporate level, but also at the higher end of the income level. But nonetheless, the IRS moving forward and doing what a lot of policymakers wanted them to do over the last few years.
All right. We'll just have to see how that turns out. WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller, thank you as always, my friend.
You bet.
And we'll post this interview at our website at federalnewsnetwork.com. And you can subscribe to The Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. With nearly 500,000 unfilled cybersecurity jobs across the country, the Biden administration is pushing a new approach to cyber hiring. White House officials have now committed to using skills-based hiring for most federal IT jobs. Agencies and contractors are exploring how to carry out that change to meet the rising demand for technology talent in government. Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday has more.
White House National Cyber Director Harry Coker says the federal government should be a leader in skills-based hiring. The idea behind the hiring approach is to focus more on an individual's talent and abilities instead of relying on education and direct experience. Coker spoke about the hiring initiative at a White House event last week.
We know that getting the best talent requires workers to be hired based on the skills they possess and their ability to learn, not just the degrees they hold. We also know how difficult it is to move to skills-based hiring.
The Office of Personnel Management is now leading an effort to transition nearly 100,000 federal cyber and IT jobs to skills-based hiring by next summer. The Energy Department is leading a corresponding initiative to move federal IT contracts to skills-based hiring. The goal isn't just to fill open cyber positions now. Advocates of skills-based hiring argue it will open more technology jobs to a wider range of applicants. Former Federal Chief Information Officer Suzette Kent says the government is in sore need of more technical talent across the board, but she says agencies will need to embrace non-traditional pathways into federal service.
We have to find talent and skill talent at a pace that matches the pace of evolving technology. That is both inside agencies, but also with our contractors. We need a bigger pool.
For years, officials across government and industry have been grappling with a lack of qualified cyber talent. But one of the big problems with cyber hiring is that many employers have been looking for what Brian Correa from the SANS Institute calls unicorns.
There's only so many unicorns in this industry. Somebody that can do A, B, C, D, E, F. It's almost in some ways, like I kind of say, it's like the LeBron of the world, right? There's only one LeBron. And as you can imagine, every basketball team's fighting for LeBron. They all want him. You know, the question is, how do you find those other players that you can build up to those skills? Because there's only so many of those folks that are out there.
A new report from SANS suggests employers should identify the specific cyber skills they need in each position and then invest more in hands-on training. The National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education Framework, known as the NICE framework, defines specific cyber work roles. But only 14% of organizations responding to a survey for SANS's report used the NICE framework for their job postings. Correa says employers need to do a better job of understanding what type of cyber jobs and skills they need.
We wanted to focus on the skills gap as opposed to the headcount gap. But as we were doing the study, the thing that popped up was it wasn't just a skills gap problem. It was also an expectations gap. What a pen tester versus a security architect versus a forensics analyst, those are completely different jobs with different mindsets, different everything.
Sands says wider adoption of the NICE framework could improve how cybersecurity leaders work with HR managers to fill cyber skills gaps. That point was echoed in Sands's report by Leidos, one of the federal government's biggest technology contractors. The company is working on several ways to improve cyber hiring. Leidos senior cyber workforce manager Lindsay Caldwell says the contractor looks for candidates who meet 80% of the must-have requirements.
And then we try to address the remaining 20% through training. We work with our hiring managers to understand what the skill gaps are. We have a cyber career development tool, and we have our employees use that tool to understand what skills that you need in a role to be successful, and also helps them understand what their skill gaps are. And then we, behind the scenes, we can see holistically where we need to train in the future.
Leidos is also developing a degree equivalency matrix that will substitute certifications, skills, training, or experience for a four-year college degree. Caldwell says the goal is to open cybersecurity roles to individuals with the right potential and skills, even if they don't follow a traditional education path.
So it's taking a look at something like a CISSP and noticing that there are 5 years required to even sit for your CISSP exam. So one could reasonably believe that you must have had at least 5 years of experience in cybersecurity if you had that certification. So could that be used in lieu of a degree? And what is enough to warrant that satisfaction between skill and experience and what you've done with your certification that could effectively replace a degree?
In some cases, organizations are also finding that they can retrain people to be cybersecurity pros. When she was federal CIO, Kent helped launch a cyber reskilling pilot. The program took current feds who were working in non-cyber fields and trained them to fill federal cybersecurity jobs. The program had some success, but Kent says many non-traditional hiring programs are often treated as an exception by agencies.
From a practical perspective, if you treat something like an exception and you evaluate those individuals differently in the way they're doing those roles, that's not a sustainable solution. That's certainly not a solution that supports volume of talent or velocity of talent.
Kent says if agencies are going to truly reap the rewards of skills-based hiring, they'll need to treat it the same as more traditional pathways into a federal job.
What I would look for as a measure of success is that we see an increase in applications. And what we see is the human capital officers and the team that these individuals might go with getting much more active and more comfortable, you know, with this process. So instead of just having one track in the door, if we can have 3, 5, 10 ways that we can find, confirm, and onboard talent, that's an advantage, you know, for everyone.
Justin Doubleday, Federal News Network.
And you can find more of Justin's reporting at federalnewsnetwork.com. It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm Eric White filling in for Tom Temin.